This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. According to a new report, the number of Vermonters who experience food insecurity has declined in the past year. That's the good news. But the report also shows that food insecurity among older Vermonters is increasing. What are some of the key findings of the report, and how does the state hope to improve food security for all Vermonters? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today. With us today, Marissa Parisi, who is the executive director of Hunger Free Vermont, and Linda Della Duca, who serves on the governor's Poverty Council. She's also a board member of the Community of Vermont Elders. Welcome to the program. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
So, Marissa, as you look at this new report, what are some of the major takeaways that you have from it that you think that our listeners should be interested in?
Well, in particular, what we were pleased with in the report is that there has been a shift in food insecurity, people reporting food insecurity in our communities. So this report is put together every year. The USDA contracts with the U.S. Census to measure food insecurity in our country, and the states get a three-year average report. So this report is actually represents 2013, 2014, and 2015. And what we've seen in those years is a reduction in food insecurity overall from about 1 in 8 to 1 in 10. So overall, that's really good news to see progress. But there is a little bit of a mixed bag in the report because we are still seeing much higher food insecurity among single parent households, which are mostly headed by women, and in minority households and also rural households. And within the report, something that concerned us in particular at Hunger Free Vermont is that senior hunger went up a little bit. And, you know, since this is a three-year average report, we're a little worried that that number isn't as representative. It could be a little worse right now. So it went up from about 7.9% of elders to 8.1%. So overall, there's some good news in here, but there's still some concern for our communities, especially with elders.
So the 2015 levels are down from 2014, but they're still higher than the levels before the Great Recession of 2008. So do we see a pretty clear link here between how the economy is doing and food insecurity levels?
Yes, I think without a doubt what this report really shows is that as the economy improves, issues like hunger are not as serious for our communities. I also think what this report shows is that the efforts of many groups and organizations and our food service directors and our schools and our communities are really effective. So this report now includes 2 years of schools implementing the Universal Free School Meals Program in 20% of our schools, which started in 2014. So seeing programs like that really take hold and take effect shows, I think, a lot of the work we're doing in our communities is helping improve food security. But without a doubt, the economy improving is the number one way we really help people stay, you know, free from hunger.
Marissa, some of our listeners might be thinking, what's the definition of food insecurity? And there's another phrase, very low food security. What does that mean?
So those are two terms used by the USDA and the U.S. Census to do this measure. And the way that it's defined is that for food insecurity, it's when people are not getting enough nutritious food on a daily basis to meet their basic needs. So that's the food insecurity category. When you get into very low food security, that's when the problem of hunger becomes much more acute. And a very low food security is when parents and children actually go without food for longer periods of time. So for Vermont, in this report, we have seen that the overall food insecurity for families has gotten a lot better. But the very low food security category, we actually got a lot better in as well. So overall, this report across the board shows we're getting better, but still there's quite a bit of vulnerability for that elder population.
And Marissa, to put Vermont's rating in context, where does Vermont rank in terms of the whole country when it comes to levels of food insecurity?
You know, we've moved around a lot, and that's where we've really kind of seen things shift in the country and Vermont in relationship to that, because it's hard to really say that our ranking is a good thing, because, you know, in terms of our ranking, we're sort of in the middle of the pack for the country. But sometimes, you know, an area of our country might get a lot worse in food security, which ends up making our ranking a lot better. So I feel like the rankings is kind of artificial to some in some ways, because in our opinion from Hunger Free Vermont, if you have anyone in your community, especially children or working families or seniors, not able to get enough food, that's a huge problem.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. What are your thoughts about hunger in Vermont? The new report says roughly 11% of all Vermonters are food insecure. What are some of the ways to help deal with this issue? Is the state doing enough to reduce food insecurity in Vermont? What role should the private sector play in solving this issue? Your thoughts, we'd love to hear from you today. 1-800-639-2211. Linda, what are some of your general thoughts as you look at the findings of this 2015 survey?
Well, I have to share Marissa's concern, particularly among seniors. That's the fastest growing demographic in the state of Vermont. And the recession really hit the what's now becoming the senior population very hard. Many of them had thought that their homes would be able to sell them and that they would be able to live off that and Social Security. And they find that they don't have the money in their housing, the equity in their housing, and they're not eligible to get new jobs. Some of them lost their job during the recession and have never been able to recoup on that end of it, too. So that really concerns me. They are also, there's a whole culture of seniors in Vermont being very proud and not wanting to admit that they aren't having enough to eat. And so it's an isolation, and it's an information, and it's also an economic issue as far as I'm concerned.
So, Linda, how do you get at some of those issues? I think I saw a statistic that said about 60% of Vermonters who are eligible for federal nutrition assistance take advantage of those programs, but that tells us 40% don't.
And I'll bet that number's higher if you go into the demographics of just the people, say, 60 and older. Well, there are a couple of things. In fact, today I sent out an email to a group I belong to, which is Vermont Retired Teachers, and asking them to start working with their friends and their neighbors in helping people apply for food stamps. There's a misconception on food stamps among seniors. They think of food stamps and they're thinking of those coupons and the embarrassment of standing in a small grocery store in a small town and digging around for coupons to pay for your groceries. And they don't know that seniors, I think it's 60, but it might be 65. Actually, the money for their food stamps is just deposited in their checking account. So nobody knows that you're using the money at the grocery store, and it can make a big difference for people if they would apply for food stamps. They also don't know that the indicators of who's eligible, the eligibility indicators, have changed in the last few years. And they think that they probably won't be eligible because they have Social Security. And in fact, that's not true. Many of them are eligible.
So, Linda, you mentioned the economic side of this. And is it the situation where most of the older Vermonters, they're on fixed incomes? Those incomes have not gone up very much in the last few years, so they're really getting squeezed?
That's part of it. In fact, I was sharing with the Poverty Council people a week ago that I am hearing from retired teachers not living in Chittenden County, therefore their incomes were not as high, and their pension is based on their income, or when they were teaching, their income, basically calling me and saying they're in trouble. They're not going to be able to stay in their current housing, and they're not going to be able to live the life that they were expecting to live. And that really concerns me, because those retired teachers have both Social Security and a pension. And if they're feeling the squeeze, there are a huge number of Vermonters who are coming along, seniors who are not going to be able to survive. Social Security is not enough to live on in Vermont.
Today on Vermont Edition, we're looking at the results of a new food security report issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. You can give us a call and join the conversation, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Your thoughts about this? We'd love to hear from you today. 1-800-639-2211. Marissa, are we also finding that a growing number of Vermonters need to rely on their local food shelves to provide them with greater food security?
Without a doubt. Hunger Free Vermont has 10 what we call regional hunger councils, where across the state of Vermont, we bring food pantries, people who work at the area agencies on aging, the CAP agencies. We bring everyone together who's working on this issue. And we hear all the time that people are rely heavily on their local food pantry, especially at towards the end of the month when their Three Squares Vermont, or as Linda said, food stamp benefits. That's Three Squares Vermont is the name for it in Vermont. When those run out, they rely on that local resource. And over the throughout the recession, we heard that they were feeling really pressured because it was just so much more demand on these small pantries that had always helped be supplemental, and now people were really relying on them quite a bit more.
And would it be accurate to say that a fair number of people, a fair number of the households who use local food shelves are actually where people are working full time?
Yeah, we've seen that quite a bit. I mean, that's what is been so difficult, and in the last few years, especially through the recession, is that with high unemployment, people did utilize things like Three Squares Vermont and free school meals and summer meals for their kids, but it was really hard to make it work. And now, when people are back to work, the majority of folks who went back to work in the recession, the folks who lost their job in the recession, had much higher incomes than what they went back to work at. So they're still trying to figure out how to make ends meet. So the food pantry system has really been heavily relied on, and as well as a lot of the programs like WIC and Three Squares Vermont and the school meal program.
Let's go to our listeners and start with Ken, who's calling from Newfane. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the program.
Greetings. Good afternoon. You mentioned the private sector, and the question I have is whether the private sector is willing to not provide charity, but to really stand up and say, yes, we are ready to provide living wages. And, you know, whether the gubernatorial candidates are willing to press the private sector on precisely this point. Because as far as I'm concerned, if you're governor of Vermont and Vermonters are going hungry, that's a true failure.
Okay, Ken, thanks very much for your phone call. Marissa, Linda, do you have a thought about that?
Well, for the population that I'm concerned about, raising the raising the living to a living wage isn't going to impact them. Mm-hmm. It's because they're seniors; they're past that point. And one of the things that I wanted to bring up that is also concerning me for seniors is our transportation issue. Chittenden County, it's possible to get to food shelves, and the food shelf will send you food or bring it to you. If you live in the Northeast Kingdom or in the more rural parts of Vermont, there may be a food shelf nearby, but if it's more than you distance you can walk, it's not necessarily accessible to you. And so our rural nature complicates things, particularly for seniors and particularly for seniors who don't have cars.
And Linda, you were talking about some of the economic issues. I think I saw a statistic the other day that said more than half of elderly Vermonters exist solely on their Social Security. Mm-hmm. They don't have retirement accounts. There's no savings account that they can rely on. And that really highlights the problem and the squeeze that a lot of people are feeling these days.
It certainly does, and I don't think when they were working full-time, they thought in terms of, they thought they had their house in many cases was going to be their sort of their fallback, and that didn't work out, and there was no plan B, because when the incomes dropped and when they lost their job, they were in the 50 bracket age-wise, there was no chance for them to get a job, and they're really in the rural parts of Vermont. There are no jobs, you know, if you're up in the logging area in the Northeast Kingdom, not a lot of jobs for loggers if you're in your 60s, you know. So they're in a real squeeze, in a real bind.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Holly, who's in Proctor. Mm-hmm. Hi, Holly. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I think that one of the things that should be said, that as a person who has actually used a food pantry in the last year, much of the food is not good quality. It is not food. I mean, we are very fortunate where we live. Our local food pantry gets wonderful things from, say, the country store, really nice things. But so much of the food and is not necessarily fresh. There is very little for people who actually cook. It's really set up more for people who do not cook. You know, it's a fast prepared food. And for instance, the paper towels you can see through the toilet paper is Soviet era quality. And there rarely are there fresh vegetables. Rarely are there flour, sugar, all the basics for making foods. It's and very little meat available. And, you know, there is some cheese, and there's wonderful dairy products from our local dairies. But still, it's not a quality of food.
Marissa, is there also a program for folks to go to their local farmers markets?
Yes, and I just want to thank Holly for her comment. Because that's true of the food pantry system, is that we have all these wonderful donors, we have wonderful people running the food pantries, and they try really hard to make sure they're meeting the need. But ultimately, what we at Hunger Free Vermont have really tried to do is help folks get that Three Squares Vermont benefit, to sign up for that, because it does give you money that you can use right in your grocery store to make your own choices. So if you are someone who cooks and are good at that, you know, with those shopping skills, to get bulk items to make your food stretch longer, it's really a great option. And that's where the farmers market program comes in. There is a program in Vermont called Crop Cash that will give you additional dollars at your farmers market to get fresh fruits and vegetables. But many, many of our farmers markets in Vermont accept Three Squares Vermont benefits so that you can get additional fresh fruits and vegetables there and grown locally. And the beautiful thing about that is that you're taking those dollars and putting them right into your community at your local farm. So we always really encourage folks who are on Three Squares Vermont to try out your local farmers markets. I think not all the time people feel like they would be able to afford something at a farmers market or aren't really sure how to navigate it. But I just want to assure everyone there's wonderful, wonderful farmers markets with great people who are there to help you navigate using Three Squares Vermont.
Marissa, we got this email from Susan. Could your guests explain how Hunger Free Vermont and the Vermont Food Bank work together? Are they competing organizations, or do they complement each other?
No, I think we're highly complementary organizations. And really, when it comes to food security, there's two arms of this work. And there is this fantastic network of charitable food organizations like food pantries and food shelves that the Vermont Food Bank does an excellent job really getting food and getting it out to their network to make sure that there is food at those pantries. The work that Hunger Free Vermont does is we focus on the federal nutrition programs, which are programs like the school meal program, child care meals, meals in the summer for kids, the Three Squares Vermont program, which is also some outreach that's done at the Vermont Food Bank at the pantries, and also do a lot of nutrition education to help folks use those Three Squares Vermont benefits. And you really do need both organizations to have those specialties to hold up that nutrition safety net. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people think that schools are just required to have a school meal program, for example. And they're not. So we've really gone school by school to help everyone set up their meal programs, make sure they're nutritious and accessible to children. So that's just an example of some of the work that we do.
Today on Vermont Edition, we're looking at the results of a new food security report just issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. What are your thoughts about hunger in Vermont? What are the best ways to deal with this issue? Is state government doing enough? What role should the private sector play? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today on the program, we're looking at the results of a new food security report issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Our guests are Marissa Parisi, who is executive director of Hunger Free Vermont, and Linda Della Duca, who serves on the governor's poverty council. She's also a board member of the Community of Vermont Elders. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Linda, I wanted to go back to your thoughts about the growing incidence of food insecurity among older people. So is this a situation where some of these older folks might start skipping meals, or perhaps they're choosing food that might fill them up but doesn't have much nutrition, and this all adds up to perhaps some health problems that they have?
You're absolutely right. That is of concern to me. Another part of that is if you're living alone and then you don't really, you know, you tend to have a bowl of cereal or a bowl of soup rather than to fix a nutritious meal. So I think there's a lot of concerns for seniors. I have concerns about them not, you know, just skipping meals or living on Cheerios, kind of. Also, I have concerns about the impact of that has on their overall health, and I think that's a concern that all Vermonters share. You do not want our senior population to not be healthy, and part of that originates by having a good diet and eating healthily. And I also would like to just point out to people that although it's not part of the Hunger Free Vermont program, seniors should check into their local senior centers, because those senior centers often have noon meals, and they're nutritious meals, and there's a certain amount of interest in eating with other people. People who are living alone tend not to eat as healthy. If they go and share a meal with someone, you tend to eat better and you seem to enjoy it more. So there's that emotional part. But that again ties back to transportation. It's a vicious cycle, as we found out on the pathways from poverty, that it's not just one item. You can't just look at the food. You have to look at housing. You have to look at transportation. And it's all going to be a serious concern as our population in Vermont ages. The equivalent of the town of Stowe turns 65 in Vermont every year, which is an astronomical number when we look at it.
That's a very interesting way of looking at it. Marissa, you mentioned earlier that there are some positive trends concerning a drop in food insecurity among young people in Vermont. What are some of the factors that have helped do that?
Well, I think there's a few things. Again, overarching, the economy getting better is really good for everyone, and you know, working parents is really important to be able to really make ends meet at home. But complementary to the economy improving, there's been a great deal of increased access to meal programs that serve children, which I think have been very helpful to these food security numbers. So, for example, this year we had a record number of summer feeding programs open in communities for children, where any child who wanted to show up and enjoy a meal and have great activities in their community could do that. And we really lose a big nutrition safety net for kids in the summer when the schools close down and they don't have access to school meals. They can get them in the summer. So having that expansion in summer meals, I think, makes a big impact. I also think two really important things have a big impact in schools, and that is many schools are working to now move their breakfast after the bell, because kids in Vermont often ride the bus to school and they take really long bus rides, and they get to school and they don't have enough time to sit down in their cafeteria and eat a breakfast. And now many schools are choosing to move their breakfast into the classroom after the bell so that kids can get that breakfast and eat in their classroom with their friends and their teacher, which is wonderful. And many of our schools who have been eligible for a new federal program called the Community Eligibility Provision, have started providing free breakfast and lunch to all kids regardless of their income. And those are in schools in our highest poverty areas. And I really do think that has made an impact, because if you think about all those parents who no longer have to provide those two meals every single school day, breakfast and lunch and sometimes snacks for kids, it helps ease the family food budget so that there's more food at home.
And Marissa, did I hear you say earlier that it's really a local decision whether or not a school participates in these school breakfast and lunch programs?
To some extent, yes. But there your school may be eligible for the program. That's the first thing you need to figure out is your school eligible for this program? And that's where Hunger Free Vermont comes in. Any school could contact us, and you've probably already been contacted by us because we do a lot of outreach, if your school is eligible to run these programs that are run with federal dollars. But the breakfast after the bell really is a school decision to make that change within your systems, within your school. So we've been working school by school to help the schools hopefully arrive at the decision that that's good for kids. Summer programs, that is definitely a community decision because the funds are available to feed children through the Summer Food Service Program federally, but we need community partners to start a great program where we can bring those meals.
So, Marissa, let's say I'm on the school board in a town that does not offer the After the Bell breakfast program. Persuade me it's a good idea.
Well, what I would probably do is tell you a story. And one story I really enjoy telling is of Thatcher Brook School, who decided to move their breakfast after the bell. And the kids now get their breakfast in the hallway. And what happened when the kids started getting their universal breakfast in the hallway is that parents would come in with their children and see how fantastic the breakfast was being served by those wonderful food service directors in that school. And they started up a conversation and a relationship with those food service directors, and they just developed a trust that wasn't there before of what wonderful food their kids were getting in school. And then when the kids brought their breakfast to their schools and or brought their breakfast into the classroom at school, their teachers just noticed how calm the morning became when everybody sat and ate together and got ready to learn and had breakfast as a community, ate it as a community, cleaned it up as a community. And that's what I think every school in Vermont should want for their kids, is kids who are ready to learn, who are hopefully getting great, fresh local food provided by wonderful community members, and really, you know, become just the best adult Vermonters we can possibly turn out in our school system. So, Bob, I hope I've convinced you now that's a good idea.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Louise, who is calling from Burlington. Hi, Louise. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm a senior. I volunteer at a local farmers market in Burlington, and it's my job to give out crop cash. And I see what a huge difference that makes to people. They are so happy about it. They can only buy fresh fruits and vegetables with crop cash. So that is a phenomenally successful program, but many people don't know about it, especially seniors. And I'd like to suggest that if we hired seniors to work part-time to explain how crop cash works and how food stamps work and how you can apply to get them, maybe more people would be able to use it. The other thing I wanted to say is that when the idea that benefits, quote, run out, end quote, near the end of the month, that seems appalling to me. We need to either increase the benefits or have some other end-of-month support for people who have no food the last week of the month. So that's all. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Louise. Linda, how about that idea of having seniors reaching out to other seniors in their community to tell them about the availability of some of these programs?
Well, that's part of what the retired teachers in Vermont are going to start doing. In fact, I was talking with them. We had our annual meeting the other day. And at first, the application process looks a little daunting, but it really isn't that complicated. And we're hoping to have retired teachers in every county in the state who know how to help people fill out the forms. And they hopefully will go to the Granges and the churches and the other places where seniors congregate in the small towns in Vermont and keep an eye out for families or for seniors that they think could benefit from this program. And as I've said to them, a lot of people, looks are deceiving, and we need to be very careful because a lot of people who we may not think are eligible are probably eligible and because of the guidelines that we have now. So I think it's a good idea. I think you're going to find a fair number of seniors who are going to do this on a voluntary basis. but it wouldn't hurt probably to stipend some of them as they have to travel around to small towns and to, you know, if you're working out of St. Johnsbury and you're headed up into Burke or something like that, it'd probably be nice to know you're getting your gas mileage covered anyway. But I think it would be a good idea. I'd like to see anything we can do to improve the quality of life for seniors. And as I say, it's a large number. It's the fastest growing demographic in the state right now.
We're almost out of time, but let's get a quick call in from Joan in Brattleboro. Hi, Joan. What's on your mind today?
What's on my mind is a lot of what the last two or three speakers spoke about, and that is understanding, even if you're interested, exactly what programs are where and where you can get the food from them. And a lot of them with these fancy names that don't indicate by the name what you can get from them, but their cutesy names don't tell you anything because you don't know with, you know, even the food stamps aren't food stamps anymore. They've got a fancy name too. How are you supposed to know where you can go and when you can go there? Each one has different days of the week that they're open, different hours they're open on those days. And it becomes absolutely impossible, particularly for somebody who's not very clear in his thinking, which a lot of older people become. And I'm pretty clear in my thinking, and I have a problem with it. That's about it.
Okay, Joan, thanks for your phone call. Marissa, almost out of time, but could this be simplified in some way?
Oh, I hope so. And I feel your pain, Joan, because it can be very hard to navigate all the resources out there. And given that we have only a little bit of time, the number one resource I would say that's really easy for Vermont to understand all of this and what's available to you is call 211. Really fantastic volunteers. Tons of knowledge. They'll really help you get what you need. And also, if you have access to the web, we run a website called vermontfoodhelp.com. You can check that out. It really has an explanation and list of everything and even a benefits calculator on what you might be eligible for.
Well, this has been a great discussion of food security issues facing many Vermonters. Many thanks to our guest today, Marissa Parisi, and also Linda Della Duca. We really appreciate you being on the program.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
And I do want to note that Marissa is a producer of a VPR partner podcast called No Makeup. Well, coming up next, I'll talk with the head of the state's highway safety program about why traffic fatalities are on the rise this year. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Highway fatalities are up more than 20% this year. So far, there have been 43 fatalities, including 10 motorcyclists and 5 pedestrians. What's happening on Vermont roads, and how are Vermont highway safety officials planning to deal with this situation? Scott Davidson is the state's highway safety program chief. I asked him why he thinks the number of overall fatalities is higher this year than in previous years.
It's always hard to tell exactly and pinpoint what would cause the increase in fatalities. But what we do know is that the economy has improved. And with an improved economy and lower gas prices, there's more highway miles being traveled. Sales of vehicles is up. Gas prices are down. More road miles being covered. That's more people on the road traveling more mileage. It just increases the risk of crash or fatality. Other than the economy, weather certainly plays a contributing factor as well. In Vermont, we have four seasons, and in those four seasons, they can vary from year to year in the severity. For example, this last winter was fairly mild. By spring breaking earlier, that's more road mileage and more time that bikes, peds, and motorcycles get out on the road. It's a longer season. The longer season, more vulnerable users. We see a spike in pedestrians and motorcycles, which we did early this spring. And that is just really based on getting out earlier in the year because the weather was milder. And when the roads are clear, the speeds increase. So I think contributing factor certainly is related to weather and how severe our winter is.
And if we look at some of the factors, we see that in more than half of the cases, the fatalities are caused in situations where the person was not wearing a seatbelt.
Yeah, and more than half folks have not been wearing seatbelts. And in this year as well, we've seen about a 50% case of speed being a contributing factor to our fatal crashes, as well as impaired driving.
So for a number of years, you've had public education campaigns about the importance of wearing a seatbelt. Does more need to be done in this area, or do you just accept the fact that some people are never going to wear a seatbelt?
Well, we'd like to think that our education efforts and what we're doing does help and is going to encourage folks to wear seatbelts. We have done a very robust campaign for education here in the state of Vermont. Just in the last year alone, we did messaging with vulnerable users, motorcycles, pedestrians, bicyclists, as well as work zone campaigns. You remember the Twilight Zone campaign that we ran recently. We did seatbelt messaging. We've been providing educational material for child passenger safety. We did a speed radio ad that we ran throughout the summer, the high speed months. We also recently put out a distracted driving message, which I think was very powerful. And finally, throughout the year, we do a significant amount of impaired driving messaging to include drug driving, holiday, Super Bowl, prescriptions. And more recently, we have been encouraging Vermonters to come up with a plan prior to hitting the highway if they anticipate that there may be alcohol involved and they may be drinking, to have a plan prior to going out. You know, we plan reservations, we plan a babysitter, but let's plan a ride home as well.
So currently there's secondary enforcement of the state seatbelt law. So this means that a law enforcement officer must have another reason to pull you over in order to write you a ticket for not wearing a seatbelt. Would it be helpful if lawmakers considered passing a primary enforcement law?
Yes, no question. I think the risk of getting caught is certainly a deterrent, and I look at it more as an educational, as being a retired law enforcement officer myself. When a law enforcement officer makes a decision on whether or not to write a ticket, they're making a decision based on whether or not a ticket, a warning, is going to suffice to change the behavior. And in so many cases, as a secondary law, we stop a vehicle, and let's say we stop the vehicle for speed, and that's what the driver is taking away, or a taillight violation, or illegal left turn, or something to that effect. We want to make sure that the message that's taken away is you need to wear a seatbelt.
So it seems like excessive speed is another key factor in a number of the fatalities this year. You know, right now, if you drive on the interstate in the right lane at 70 miles an hour, almost everybody is whizzing by you. The interstate is kind of like a racetrack. And at the same time, I wonder if that situation spills over to some of the smaller secondary roads where people are speeding as well. Is it my imagination or are people driving faster?
I don't have any data to suggest they are driving faster, but anecdotally, it seems to be what people are taking away from their personal observations. We're certainly hearing a lot more about it through media, and it's a big piece. And when we know that half of the fatal crashes so far this year have been speed-related, that in itself should send us a message to slow down.
So how do you get people to slow down?
From a behavioralist perspective, I would say that that'd be through education and enforcement. It's a combination of both. I think we can educate folks upon the risk of what would happen if they do speed, and at the same time provide a consequence for when they do through enforcement.
Another key factor in some of these fatalities involves driver impairment because of alcohol or drugs. What do you think is the most effective way to deal with this issue? Is this another public education campaign?
I think a multifaceted approach to impaired driving is really the best way to go. And that could be through education and continuing to do the same messaging, letting folks know that there is a consequence. You will be arrested if you do drive impaired. We also want folks to know the risks of what would happen if they do drive impaired and what could happen. And then finally, I think there's a treatment piece. One of the programs that we are funding right now is DUI Treatment Court. And we are looking at other forms of way to help folks be successful after being arrested for DUI to make sure that doesn't become a recidivism and that it doesn't happen in the future. And we are looking at many different countermeasures, hopefully, to employ to help reduce that risk.
So, Scott, if I look at the statistics, I see that more than half of all fatalities involve the lack of a seatbelt use. About half of them are cases of driver impairment due to alcohol and or drug use, and about half of them are because of speed or aggressive driving. So that tells me that a number of accidents are actually a combination of these factors. So does that pose yet an additional problem?
The combination of speed, impaired driving, and not wearing a seatbelt is is deadly, and that's proven here in the statistics and proven in the numbers that we see every year. And it's been a consistent number. This is not unique to the state of Vermont. Every state in the union faces the same exact message, and that's if you drive impaired, you speed, and you don't wear your seatbelt, it's got deadly consequences.
Let's talk for a moment about distracted driving. A lot of this involves the use of handheld electronic devices like cell phones. Despite a state law prohibiting these devices, it seems like a fair number of people are still using them. Is it just really hard to enforce this law?
No, we're certainly enforcing it. Law enforcement is out, and they're issuing tickets for this violation. I think one of the factors to consider, if we take a look at the early 1970s, seatbelt use rate in the state of Vermont was in its 20s. We're at 86% right now. And we began messaging throughout that period of time, Vince and Larry, and wear your seatbelt. And it took a good decade before those numbers rose to 86. We're not going to get there overnight. We need to continue to remain vigilant. We need to continue with enforcement. We need to continue with education. And ultimately, we need to change a culture.
Scott Davidson is the Highway Safety Program Chief for the state of Vermont. Scott, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you.
That is Vermont Edition for today. Tomorrow, my guest will be the Republican candidate for Lieutenant Governor, Randy Brock. We'll discuss health care reform, tax policy, and ways to improve the Vermont economy. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Thanks for listening.